Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Sarah Rabia. She's an award-winning global content marketer and cultural insight expert based in Los Angeles. She's got over 20 years experience in content creation, insight, and disruptive brand strategy, specializing in tech, fashion, and beauty. She is also running a co-founder of Backslash Content Studio at TBWA Chai at Day in Los Angeles. She's been awarded Business Insider's Top 10 Most Creative Women in Advertising Award. And then prior to being at the agency in LA, she was a strategist over at BBH in London. Before that, she was a strategist at Mother. And before that, she was at the Future Laboratory. And before that, at the Mighty Face magazine. So one of those, an absolutely amazing and really, really interesting career path. So no doubt we'll be talking about all of that when we get going, along with some of her really, really fascinating insights into where we are now, what's going on, and then what's coming up next. So anyway, Sarah Rabia, how are you in sunny Los Angeles?
Thank you for the very kind introduction. It's not so sunny yet. It's getting to that grey mornings you have in LA, but it will come out soon. But yeah, there's no children around me. I've had a coffee, so I'm pretty good.
Well, worse places to be than fairly grey at the moment morning, but a sunny LA, I could certainly do with a bit of that today. So go on then, Sarah. I mean, I know you've been out there for quite a while, but before we talk about what you're up to at the moment in LA, I mean, with all of these podcasts, I think it's been really interesting just to ask everyone to go through, if you like, how they got to where they are now. So so go on then, because I know you were at London College of Fashion back in the day. Perhaps just talk us through that, and then talk us through what you've been up to over the years since, who you've been working with, and, some of the sort of dynamic things that you've been involved in.
Sure. Yes, I study journalism. I probably knew from 15-ish, I wanted to be a writer, a fashion journalist, mostly because I couldn't sew or draw very well, but I could write. I started there, very vocational degree, but I did a lot of work experience. That's the thing I tell lots of young people today. Just get tons of experience on your CV working for great magazines. I walked Alexander McQueen's dog and looked at a picture of a giant asshole in his bedroom. I had many experiences interning. And all that experience landed me my first proper job at The Face magazine, as you mentioned, which actually was taught me a lot about strategy. I edited a kind of early version of brand content for Levi's within the magazine and their style pages and stuff. Got paid an absolute pittance, but learned a lot of my craft, really, about how to write and research. And then that was sort of that era. I was at the sort of tail end of The Face and that era of like Heat magazine, all those tabloid mags.
Thing.
And that's what kind of got me into trend forecasting, the Future Laboratory you mentioned, where actually you used to freelance for us. That's how we our paths crossed. And kind of coincidentally, Martin Raymond, who's one of the co-founders of the Future Laboratory, was my journalism teacher at university. So there was a sort of link there. And as you know, forecasting, the approach I have and the Future Lab had, is very journalistic. It's, a lot about stories and patterns. I feel like there's kind of symmetry in what I've done, and forecasting kind of naturally in some ways led me into strategy, because it's a lot about helping brands navigate the future, understanding their consumers, what should they do next. And I found myself at the Future Laboratory loving the bit in our reports where we'd say, what does this mean for your brand? And thing got me excited. And I did this workshop with a client, and that was, it was about applying it and seeing an end product. As much as I loved, I did many reports at Future Laboratory where you were kind of in an ivory tower sometimes. You know, I had months to research some of this stuff.
But happy days.
But it's nice for it to see the light of day and it to be on a shelf or out in the world. Or, you know, you mentioned saying to your mum, like when your mum's seen some of your work, I think, you know, that's when it's real. It's not just a can of water winning, you know, maybe. I got into strategy after that, advertising, you know, and I guess the goal was to really help brands be more cultural. That's sort of the connection, understanding culture and getting it out there. And at first it was, you know, I think advertising liked me because, oh, she's a journalist and she's done trends. And I spent a bit of time when I first got into advertising trying to kind of lose that. It's what that people liked about me, but I kind of wanted to prove I was a proper strategist, if you like, which has made me move from mother, which was more me culturally, to BBH. And it was at BBH, I mean, I had a great experience there. I definitely became a better strategist, great mentors like Jim Carroll. Where I realized, actually, this is the thing that makes me different and kind of innovative. I did, you know, a lot of the work I've done wasn't typical ads. It was services, content. And I sort of made very, very early versions of Backsplash, which is the content culture lab studio I run now. That entrepreneurial thing. And so I kind of, then I realized I need to embrace this, that I'm a hybrid, and it's great that I can be a journalist, a forecaster and a strategist. And I'm a bigger picture thinker, but for a while, I think I had a little chip on my shoulder that I wasn't the most single-minded, you know, strategist. And then LA kind of beckoned because I was looking for a life change, really. I think I was burned out before burned out was a phrase. And that London lifestyle in your late 20s, early 30s, you know. And LA made a lot of sense because, one, it's English speaking, gorgeous weather, beach, and there's been this sort of migration. Sounds a bit wanky, but the creative classes moving here, tech, entertainment, fashion. That was interesting to me. I think LA is the kind of the birthplace of a lot of trends and fusion, and it's been an amazing lifestyle. This is my fifth year here, working at TBWA, and I think as well as the beach, which was definitely the driving force to bring me here, I kind of had a bit of an open brief on the job. I initially had one client, but my boss kind of said to me, Nick Barham, who's now left to work for an interesting kind of startup for founders, his brief to me was really help me make the network more cultural, connect to culture, let's invent new products, new ways of doing things. And that was really exciting for me. I want someone to riff off and figure it out with me. And that definitely appeals. I'm someone that loves autonomy and a blank page, and so building something like Backsplash was like my best brief. I had 3 months that the brief was make a video a day about culture to make the network smarter, and I had 3 months budget promotion at the end of it if I did it, and I just loved concepting that and building it. I think it's one of the best jobs in advertising, and it's been my, you know, dream job in advertising for a long time.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, on that, by the way, I mean, it's such an interesting career path, because such interesting agencies that you've worked with, having been, you've seen through sort of Future Lab and then Mother and BBH and TBWA, etc. I mean, one of the real sort of critiques of the industry in general, if you like, to counterbalance that, is that it's the industry that, you know, just effectively churns out noise. Everyone's trying to shout louder than everyone else. And I thought it was really interesting, one of the recent reports that you wrote, that you sent me, Zero Out, that talked about, you know, we're living in an age of noise. Silence is almost extinct. You've got to create your own. You know, the quote you took from Erling Kagge, author of Silence in the Age of Noise. So perhaps just talk a bit about that in terms of what you were, exactly what the Zero Out project was all about and what your research told you.
Yeah, that's one of my favourite, we call them edges, like cultural shift. And it came about a couple of years ago is when I was getting the feeling for it. And I think it was a point in culture where there was a lot of kind of weird, wacky marketing. You know, memes were a big thing. We were seeing lots of brands doing kind of crazy millennial stuff like Taco Bell and kind of funny Twitters like Arby's. And I think, you know, as you know, we're forecasting there's always a reaction to something or a parallel. So in this noise and chaos, I just had this sense of nothingness and less. And we've had things like that before, but it was this idea of blank and this idea of the word zero, which I think I was just seeing more and more on products, zero parabens, you know, it's free, you know, people becoming more so going sober and that being trendy. So all these ideas were kind of fusing. So probably for about a year and a half, 2 years, I'd been thinking about this, reading books, like you said, Erling's beautiful book. And interestingly, I finally sort of wrote that report just before COVID hit. And it is quite foreboding of this moment, this great pause that happened. And maybe not quite in the same way, but you talked about the sort of noise that brands make. There's a section in the report where we talk about absence marketing. And I do think that can be very powerful. You know, as you say, everyone's got an ad blocker. You know, you just, even right now during COVID, the amount of emails you're getting with sales pitches, another insights, COVID insights deck. Webinar is just, you know. And so the idea of taking a step back, of celebrating or embracing your absence in a customer's life, I think is very Zero Out and very interesting. And I talk about, you know, there's a history of brands like Patagonia and Orange celebrating moments when you switch off their brand or telling you not to buy it. But I think it's interesting. Yeah. There's this idea of abstaining from things. This is very Gen Z and millennial. People buying less, not eating meat, renting as much as possible. And I think brands need to kind of embrace their abstinence culture. It might be, for example, like in beauty, there's a movement called skin fasting, a bit like, you know, any kind of fasting where you don't use any skincare products. But it's just this idea of detoxes from products and industries and how you can actually celebrate that rather than pushing against it. Okay, what can we learn about this culture? Is there an innovation that comes out of that, a new fan base? I think, you know, Zero Out, I think it's really, you know, manifesting now. We're having to live with less and we're looking for that inner, you know, there's a real meditative quality to it. And if you know anything about Buddhism and all of that stuff, you'll be like, oh, this is not new. In some ways, it's not. It's a lot of the Eastern philosophies have understood that idea of our need for silence and calm and quiet in our life. But it's quite a new idea in Western culture that we've really struggled to fit into our life. And I think COVID has forced us to find that pause, to live with less. And
really interesting. Just going back slightly, before we come back to that point, that was a really interesting thing you're talking about, sort of, you know, brand abstinence and all the rest of it, and, you know, and the quiet and the calm. I remember one always has to talk about William Gibson, obviously, in any conversation with a forecaster. And I remember back in Pattern Recognition, but he has that character Hubertus Bigend, who ran the sort of fictitious forecasting agency Blue Ant. And one of the things that they would do was make a lot of money by making sure that nobody found out about the brands they're working for. So this great thing, he came up with the idea of, you know, brands that just wanted to be sort of secretive, so they would ensure that no one ever found out about them. Absolutely fantastic. But also, I think it's really interesting in that in the in the zero out report you did, me talking again about, there's a really interesting quote by Gordon Hempton, who talks about quiet places have been on the road to extinction at a rate exceeding that of the extinction of species. And so that's amazing. So, you know, if last year and now, obviously, but particularly last year, if one of the most powerful voices and deliberately loud voices, vitally loud voices, was Extinction Rebellion, you know, talking about, you know, obviously the ecological catastrophe, etc. I mean, incredible that also you're putting, or he's putting in that context of quiet spaces being under a similar level of danger.
That is, yeah, he's an acoustic ecologist, so that connection between silence.
Great job.
And there. Yeah, that's fascinating, wasn't it? I mean, your book, you talk a lot about Extinction Rebellion being a kind of new form of influence. And I think with Zero Out and Nate, there is a real connection between nature and silence. And I think accelerate that, you know, coming out the other end of this, we're going to be craving the outdoors. Climate change has taken a bit of a hit from our consciousness as we kind of grapple with staying alive, but that will be back. And I think there'll be, you know, I think for the travel industry and many others, really bringing nature back into our life, into our homes. People, 70% of people I read the other day want to make their homes healthier, houseplants, non-toxic paints. So you can see ecology and climate activism feeding through into all of that. And, you know, a lot in the report, again, I looked a lot at sort of Gen Z's behaviors. They're abstaining from things, whether it's alcohol, meat, stuff, materialism. Mm. And it's, you know, it's very much connected to saving the planet.
And it's interesting, and that point also you're talking about sort of nature and silence. And it's great the way that, as you mentioned, nature, I could hear a bird in the background in your garden in LA. But there's one of the campaigns you talk about there that links to, you know, obviously a country as brand is the campaign done for Finland, where the line was, you know, come to Finland where nothing happens. And the resulting campaign said, but it was just named Silence, Please. Yeah. Really fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that shows the shift, you know, that.
And yeah.
Again, there's a reframing of stuff. Nothing happens, or silence is a luxury. We did a report for Backslash about a year ago about reframing aloneness. So, you know, there's been this loneliness process. And our flip was, you know, not to undermine that loneliness, there's some real issues with that. But there's a difference between being alone and being lonely.
And
same way, is it nothing or is it something? Is it nothing or is it silence? Is it space? And that, and I think the Finnish campaign managed to reframe that. And again, I think COVID's interesting because I think for many of us, you know, as I've been moaning to you about, I'm stuck in a house with two young children and there ain't no pause. There's no space. It's like, I had this calm. I'm certainly not making fucking sourdough. So, sorry. But, you know, all these people that are like doing up their house, it's like I'm busier and more burned out than ever. And yet for others, you know, they're lonely and missing that social connection. And solitude, again, solitude, space, silence, I think connected. They are absolute luxuries. The idea of having a few moments to myself will become much more prized, and that calm and quiet. But I also think, you know, we're all, I think as much as traumatic as some of this stuff is, and, you know, that the economy's taken a real grave hit, and I don't want to sort of underplay some of the terrible stuff, I think there is some good to come out of this, and that we are, totally. And you know, we like people are Marie Kondoing their friendships. I don't need that person in my life, etc. And I think it may be needed. You know, your work with Extinction Rebellion, like we had to be forced. We do need a change to the system. It wasn't all great before. You know, we had a mental health crisis. Work was burning us out and not making us rich. And so I do hope that this will lead to bigger changes. And maybe I will get my little solo travel nature holiday at the end of it.
Excellent. And then, but also, by the way, that thing about solitude and then aloneness not being the same as loneliness. Interesting, you also mentioned Billie Eilish in there. And you're saying there in the report, you're saying that, you know, Billie Eilish provides a soundtrack to nothingness. Perhaps just talk a bit about that.
Yeah. So again, I think a lot of what's really interesting about this shift that we're calling Zero Out is very much driven by this generation, Gen Z. If you think about, you know, your generation and Martin's, Sean, you know, you guys are the ecstasy generation, that you're, you know, that analogy.
Happy days.
Ravers, you know, your drugs define you. And I just thought a lot about, you know, Xanax, that is the drug of choice. Z, cannabis, CBD. And it's not the cannabis, you know, the stoner, you know, bong age. This is like, you know, premium CBD in your beauty, etc.
Yeah.
There's a lot in there. And I think artists like Billie Eilish, you know, she absolutely just captures this idea of absence. The tone of her music, the way she styles herself, this kind of anonymity almost. We don't really know what she looks like, and very purposeful. She doesn't oversaturate herself. And so you talked a little bit earlier about William Gibson and that idea of mystery. Again, there's something a little bit there that I think is interesting as well. And there's a book I read as well, very millennial kind of novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. And again, it's this idea of being able to absent ourselves that can be a form of transformation. It's a bit of a bleak, dark book in some ways, but this woman goes to sleep for a year because she just wants a new life. She wants to escape. There's, again, I think connected to Billie, there's just this feeling of wanting this nothingness, of not wanting to feel. It's, you know, it's connected to a lot of their anxieties about nature, etc. If anyone's seen the show Euphoria, HBO, I think that captures this mood as well.
I haven't heard of that. So go on then.
Yeah, it's a great show on HBO, but it's just, it's the same themes, you know, and I think, as you know, from forecasting, you just see patterns, and that's how the idea builds up. I think from pop music to novels to TV to what's happening with the environment, you know, we absolutely just want to hit this pause button, consume less, feel less.
Yeah. Talking about that book, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, being bleak and dark, perhaps the reading a bleak and dark book would be perfect on your holiday in Finland. There we are. That could combine the two of them. So.
Yes,
probably going to have very well there. But again, I thought it was really fascinating that again, very eloquently put in the report, and you're saying, you know, that the shift isn't just aesthetic, but it's also linguistic, and the language of zero is entirely embraced. Zero parabens, zero pesticides, zero alcohol, zero carbon, zero waste. These zero brands are defining themselves by absence. Yeah. Nicely put.
Thank you. Yeah, as you can see, I'm better when I'm writing things down than when I'm rambling on a podcast. But that was
not at all great.
That was an early idea I had. Just, you know, as you know, just this idea of zeros kept coming to me, and then I spoke to a senator, and I think we both know Chris Arning about this as well.
Yeah.
We had a good conversation about the meaning of zero, because it can be both a fullness and an absence. And I think in Western culture, we think of less as less, you know, it's filled of anything. But if you think about in marketing, something like the clean beauty movement, for example, it absolutely sells itself on absence, on zero. It's, you know, the beauty counter has a never list of all the things it doesn't contain. And if you look, you know, look in your bathroom at what your shampoo says, it will talk about what's not in the product rather than what's in it. And I think that's a big marketing flip and a big opportunity for, you know, whether you're an alcohol brand selling yourself on what you don't contain.
Or
a luxury skincare brand.
I'll say also, by the way, in terms of zero, great track by the Yeah. Now, there we are. So I always have to mention the mighty Karen O. What about, you also mentioned in there the, I never knew this, that you say that in the Netherlands, they embrace pointlessness and they call it Nixon.
Yeah. I mean, this
the
is
the literal meaning to do nothing. Amazing.
This is one of the things I love about Backslash. I've got a network of 250 culture spotters in there.
Nice.
The Dutch ones are very amusing. I think there's a British-Dutch humour connection. Yeah, so
yeah.
My spotters talk to me about Nixon, and it's a bit like, I never say this word right, Heiger.
Oh, yeah.
I said pronouncing that right, just one of these kind of European sort of trends and it's been part of the Netherlands, their culture for a while, that you have time where you do nothing. And that really does mean do nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
Potter about or listen to birds. It's not something in American culture or certainly not British culture.
Sure.
Become trend again.
Yeah, I was about to say, probably going to get down really badly in New York. What are you doing? Relaxing. What? Get up. Okay, then. And then what about the whole issue of, to go back a bit in terms of, and by the way, you mentioned sort of Billie Eilish, just quick on that. Over here last weekend, you know, would have been Glastonbury Festival, obviously, a week or so ago, but obviously that was cancelled due to the pandemic. So they re-showed, you know, the best of years and years and years, and they showed last year when Billie Eilish sort of like, you know, did her first sort of set there, and how it's absolutely brilliant. She was absolutely sort of blew everyone away. It was incredible, so spectacularly, obviously, mega talented and so inspiring. But to go back to sort of slightly separate things, so just in terms of agency world and the different sort of atmospheres and agencies, perhaps just talk us through that for those that, you know, aren't familiar with it. So, you know, just from your point of view, you know the different atmosphere between literally a mother or a BBH or a TBWA or somewhere else. So when you sort of, you know, float around different agencies, I mean, is there still a big sort of difference in culture and attitude and atmosphere in agencies, or are they all very sort of, you know, incredibly similar, or what? How do you see it? What's your experience been?
I mean, certainly coming to America, there's differences in generations, cultures, countries, and there is a connection. Mother, I think, was definitely more me culturally. It reminded me in some ways of being at the Face. Everyone was a bit of a character. You knew who a mother person was. Very open. You know, everyone was a creative. That's all. I think that's one of the flaws of advertising. You have this department called creatives and everyone else.
Title.
But Mother kind of dismantled that a lot. And I think the way that they kind of cast and recruited people was quite particular. And I think everybody felt invested in the work. But it was also, you know, that was a time in my life, late 20s, where, you know, everyone was working hard, partying hard. It was a kind of lifestyle job. So I think also, you know, depending on your age, an agency can feel different. Like when I became a mother, you know, my experience of agency life was different. I think, depending on what you want, I moved from Mother to BBH. I wanted to be a better strategist, and there were people I could learn from. There was a more disciplined approach to strategy. And I absolutely got that and collected these incredible mentors and, but culturally it wasn't the right, you know, the best fit for me, but it made me better. So I think, you know, you have to think about, the time of your life, what you want to get out of that experience, and also what you're going to give to it. You know, I talked a bit about, like, when I was transitioning from journalism and trends, I mean, that was the thing that I could offer these agencies. I've got something that other strategists don't have, and I could bring and leverage that. I think that's also important, you know, what you contribute. But in return, you know, I want to learn, or I want to get work out. You know, Mother absolutely had such amazing opportunities to make the best work. And I've got that at BBH as well. Again, I could offer them something different from their mold. TBWA, I think, has been, again, a mixed experience. I think, you know, American corporations, that's maybe been the biggest culture shift for me versus the UK. You know, the British humour, being self-deprecating, the banter, you just absolutely wouldn't get away with that here. And, you know, many Brits that don't end up in HR for some reason or other. But some of that is also, you know, at the same time I moved to America, you know, things have become more fractious and policed and more sensitive. And a lot of that is for good, you know, for good reasons. But, you know, I would say, I think some American companies, you need a safe space to have some, you know, you need creative tension. You need to have to, it's not always a negative thing. And create the right environment for that. I think Mother, that was part of the culture, but it didn't feel aggressive. Felt like it was in service of the work. I think that is important. You know, I've loved from TBWA. It is a massive network, but it's its strength. It really is truly global. And having a global role, I've just thrived. I'm fascinated, and I love that I can connect with Johannesburg, Shanghai, Melbourne. I have, you know, this network of people all around the world, and I've just absolutely loved that. And, you know, in my role, I'm working with, you know, some of the best talent in the network and some of the young talent as well. A lot of my spotters are the young, you know, strategists, and they have a different kind of outlook on stuff.
Fascinating. Okay, then next, moving on. What about completely separate, or not actually sort of that hugely sort of a separate subject, and that is where work is going, because the, you know, obviously over the last few months with the pandemic and obviously the whole working from home thing, blah, 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 you know, there's been you know, an enormous amount of change about the way people are doing what they do, and enormous amount of debate about where everyone's going to go. Are they going to go back? Are they not going to go back into buildings, into city centres? Are we going to see the sort of the donut economy of city centres sort of emptying out and all the rest of it, alongside all the other social tensions? All those things happening at the same time. What does it mean in terms of agency world and what agencies do and how they articulate what they're doing and what brands stand for? And you mentioned earlier on about it, it's that bizarre thing of agencies seem so old fashioned in many ways, and that you have, you know, the creative bit and the thinking bit and the doing bit and all the rest of it. So as all these things clash together, what does that mean for sort of the future of agency work and future of agency roles, do you think?
I'll start a bit broader with work. We've done quite a lot of work on this. So, you know, if anyone is looking for shit, what's the future of work, or some ideas from my agency, have a look at the / site. But I think, you know, as you know, there's been lots of trends and shifts that we're tracking pre-COVID that have just been accelerated. Now, some of that's new and some of that is just sped up. But a lot of, you know, I would say pre-COVID, we were falling out of love with work. I think there was this realization, you're not your job. Work was making us sick, this burnout pandemic. And, you know, things like the American dream, we were realizing it doesn't work anymore. We're following the rules. We're not getting rich, you know, unless you're Bezos. And I think we were starting to see something, I think, that will happen more post-pandemic, but people starting to create more boundaries between work and life. You know, work-life balance for a lot of us just ended up being this sort of juggle. And I think the pandemic has just, you know, made having a work-life balance even harder as we are stuck in our bedrooms while our children scream downstairs at us. But those boundaries will come. I think is going to be important. We talk about work-life boundaries. And I think that's, you know, the pandemic, what's kind of partly new, partly accelerated by the pandemic is this, you know, this realization works. It's not, it doesn't define us. It doesn't fulfill us. It's not making us well. And I think a lot of people are reflective now about what they want to do with their lives, where they want to be. It's certainly forced companies to really, like, accept that remote working does work. You don't need to be in an office 24/7. I think there's been so much reluctance around flexible working. And I, you know, I think a lot of us are not going to go back to the old ways. They're expensive. You know, you don't need all those overheads. So I think there's, you know, reimagining the office. But, you know, you talked a bit to get a bit more specific about agencies. You know, I think a great agency does thrive on that in-person creative collaboration that can sometimes be messy. Sometimes there's a bit of tension there. But I don't think that has to be in the structure of one physical place 5 days a week. And it's certainly not 9 to 5 anymore. And those, the hours of advertising, I think, have got to change. They don't make business sense and they don't work the way that people want to live their lives now, particularly young people, I think parents. So I'm really interested in how we can create physical, creative spaces to work in. And also, I think, improve upon, you know, the virtual ways of doing it. You know, we're all, I hate the cliche, Zoom fatigued, but I think we are incredibly Zoom fatigued. There's some benefits of that. And again, to go back to some of the zero out stuff, you know, people need space and idle time and solitary time to be really creative, and they need to not be following the same patterns. You need to break away from the traditional. So I think more solitary solo time is going to be important in the way that we work. I think that's very important for a creative industry. You need stimulating space to collaborate physically with people. I think, you know, another thing from sort of my background, like I've always, like in the way that I work, I've always built a network beyond the agency. So if I'm doing some research, I might talk to an academic, or I might do a little research documentary or something like that. And just using kind of skills that I learned in journalism and forecasting that I've taken to TBWA. So I think a more expansive network that, again, doesn't have to be just the few people in your metropolitan elite office. You know, something exciting that I think we're going to see that's going to be great for diversity and I think regenerating rural areas is, I think a lot of people are going to move out of cities. They're going to want to live where they want to live, somewhere cheaper, maybe somewhere near nature. I see that a lot with kind of white collar jobs like advertising. And I think if agencies can support that, you can really expand your talent. And again, I think it makes us think differently about diversity. It's not just being kind of race, but kind of geography as well. And, you know, imagine that talent pool was even beyond your country. I mean, that's something I've learned a lot from TBWA as well, really blending different geographies, different specialisms. It doesn't really matter where people sit. Like sometimes with projects, like I'll get asked, we just want to look at technology in America. And I have to talk about, well, technology doesn't exist in a silo. You need to be looking at health right now and fashion.
Yep.
You know, rather than just America, you need to look at Chinese internet culture. I think it's the same thing, you know, so that's a much more expansive big picture view will really help advertising. And, you know, again, like, I mean, every agency wants to be breaking out of just doing ads and getting into whether it's performance marketing or content. And you need different skills for that, and they might not all be housed in London or Los Angeles, and you might need to find more nimble ways of doing it. Maybe it's about having people working within a client, you know. So I think, you know, like the upside of all this is that if we embrace the innovation, we can build a stronger, more exciting industry. Like, you know, I miss the days of, you know, getting Porsches and long lunches with champagne.
Yeah.
Those advertising days are gone, but it would be nice to get that excitement back. Because I think if we're honest, you know, if you're a graduate or, you know, maybe you're not going to college because it's too bloody expensive, what do you want to get into? Maybe you want a startup. I'm not sure advertising is the first choice anymore. And I think it needs to find its relevance again. And this is a chance. I hope as well, like, again, connected a bit to networks and different disciplines that advertising can build, you know, that we can really make the business model work for freelancers and specialists, you know, people like you, maybe people like me. You might not
be
on the payroll every day, but maybe there's a project that's, you know, fantastic for them, and that you really get the best brains for a client. Because I think that's sometimes why clients will, you know, seek out a freelance consultant or go to a specialist agency that does X, and if they can make that business model work, which I think will help a lot of people that want a more flexible job. I had a woman working for me. She was an artist, and she ended up working 3 days a week for us and then doing her art and, you know, things like that. There's just different ways of working. Parents.
Yeah.
I don't think parents want to go back to that crushed model. And I really hope fathers, because, you know, white men have a lot of power in this industry, really demand that they leave the office early, as it were, and really that's when the culture will change, when men force things.
Yeah. These sort of brutal realities of that. If I'm just going back slightly, we're talking about the issues that I think really link into the future city and the way that cities are evolving. I remember years ago, I gave a couple of talks with Richard Florida when he'd just written the sort of Rise of the Creative Class, and then obviously later he wrote things like The New Urban Crisis. And so he was a great champion of the growth of the secondary city, and where things were all going next. But just moving on, another report I thought was really interesting that you did with Backslash was culture after COVID from the point of view of the convenience economy. And what was going to, so perhaps just I know you mentioned a couple of things in there already, but just to be clear about what that report was all about and where you see what the convenience economy is going to look like, all things post-pandemic.
Yeah, so when kind of COVID hit, we changed the way we were doing our content for Backslash, and a lot of our content is internal only, but there's some public work here. We wanted to look at what the world would be like post-pandemic. How can we get our clients and our agency ahead? And there's a lot of focus, still, I think, about the present moment and not enough about the opportunities, beyond, and how we can prepare for that. And so we looked at it through the lens of our different edges, different themes, if you like. Convenience economy is one of the cultural shifts we've been monitoring for at least 2 years. But it's really interesting to think about the concept of convenience and how that's changed under COVID. We took for granted on demand, pre-COVID, we couldn't do anything. It would arrive at our doorstep. Suddenly you can't get toilet paper for love no money. And that, these faceless delivery people now are the heroes, the essential workers that keep the world running. The workers' rights and strikes and stuff that's going on around that. And we talk about in the report, there's a mini deck on our website if anyone's interested, about how post-pandemic the convenience economy will grow a conscience. And there's years of conscious consumerism there. I think I think the real cost of convenience we haven't confronted and accepted. Those Amazon workers and those warehouses making sure we get our deliveries the same day. And I think in general, again, with the Black Lives Matter movement as well, brands and businesses need to look internally first and really think about how they're treating their own staff. It sounds obvious, but there's been a lot of, what are we saying? It's Black Lives Matter. Do I do a black post? Or, internally about how you're caring and treating for your own people, because it doesn't matter if you do X hashtag or Y donation, if you're not treating your staff with care and respect.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a new theme within convenience. I guess the consciousness and the heart is going into it. But also, I think we did a report for McDonald's a while back, and we looked a bit about the sort of trade-offs within convenience. You can get something fast, but it's low quality. And I think we have to collapse those dichotomies, because I think consumers are really demanding. We've seen that. They want it fast. They want it now. They want it ethical. They want it intuitive. But one of the themes as well, I think, that we'll see more of is, I think companies need to be more responsible. It's not just, I've asked for it, give it to me. It's a sense of what's good for me, what's good for the planet. For example, if we think about social media, rather than just feeding us, misinformation on our feed, I think companies need to be a bit more responsible to I'm not going to say censor that, but there needs to be much more regulation around that, for example. And even, giving us things that we might not see. I think the idea of the anti-algorithm is very interesting. The BBC has done an app where they throw up music that you might not discover. I'm slightly going on a tangent, but I guess there's a morality in convenience economy. And I think if I was in that bit, and I think all, many businesses have had to, even if they didn't think of themselves as a convenience brand, they now have to be convenient. How do I get this to my customer at the house? Because they're not going to come to the store or visit this experience. So, delivery, a virtual way of experiencing my product, making things easy. I think, I talked a bit about Amazon recently, and I think a lot of people, have a moral quandary with that brand, but it is just, no one's really beating it on efficiency, right? And it's, I remember reading an article about mothers who were like, I don't really like the brand, but it's like my helper. I can just subscribe to nappies. I don't need to think about it. And they're always there. And so I'd love more brands to kind of try and beat them on that, or maybe work with them. You know, maybe there's some smaller independent brands that can use Amazon's, you know, delivery system, but then they bring the quality of product and personal service on top of that. But I think no one's really kind of matched them there. And I think, unfortunately, like, I think COVID has forced a lot of us, we have to, you know, we are having to make compromises, but the brands that can collapse those trade-offs, I think, will win.
Fascinating. Okay, look, so in that case, if I could just one last question, because I'm aware that you you're busy and that you have to go into another meeting in a while. So just one final question, and it's been really, really great. So thanks for so much for your time. So if you were advising a million dollar question, if you were advising a the strategist, planner, forecaster of tomorrow, so the person that's currently at college and looking to get into the industry in some way, just to be clear about the sort of skills you think are needed for, you know, the ideal person to do that job.
That's a nice question. Maybe I'm a bit biased, but I do have a lot of respect and gratitude to the way I was trained by the Future Lab guys, you know, one from university. I think journalism's been a really great grounding for strategy, storytelling, great research, being able to get content out into the world. I think that's a great skill, looking for patterns. Data is really important. That's been something newer in my career. It wasn't, you know, we talked about quant, now it's data. Maybe you don't have that skill, but you know how to access it, or you have people in your network that are great data scientists. If I was coming up now, I'd get a handle on that. Being more commercial as well, I think is important. If we think about, you know, startup culture, VC culture, and advertising is, you know, really trying to make itself more commercial. Understanding business as well, I would love to see that more in college courses and things, but just the kind of mindset of, I think, like, I'm not technically Gen X, but I identify more with that. I feel like that was something in our culture and the culture of advertising and things. Business was, there was sort of a divide, really, art and business, or art and commerce. And
yeah,
I think younger people and younger brands today, they kind of collapse that. And it's like, I think of a Glossier, it's like, great business, they monetize editorial, they're selling these great products, but it's, you know, they're doing it through a Slack channel with their customers. Like, I think that it's really interesting that blend of commercial and creative thinking, but more hybrid. I think, you know, I still think things like forecasting scene is a bit of a nice to have and a bit fluffy, which is where the comments and the data can help you proving things. I still think, you know, my best thinking comes from those little goosebumps or gut feelings, like, oh, something about zero, and then, you know, I research it. But when I can kind of validate it or apply it, so when I can say this is what it means for your brand, or what if McDonald's did X, that's what people really need, and that's where the gap is, I think, in this whole market. You know, there's lots of insights out there and information and data, but you have to help clients figure out what to do with it, and so the implementation is really important, which again I think is one of the brilliant things about advertising. We apply the thinking, we make something at the end of it. Be a maker and a thinker, and you know, we have to do, I think it's becoming a little bit more generalist in a way, as a strategy. You do have to do a lot of things, but maybe you don't have to be an expert in all of them. You just need to know enough and know who to tap and be a bit of a
Very, very interesting. Well, on that note, fantastic. I love the thing about goosebumps and gut feeling. Absolutely fantastic. But Sarah, I'm aware that our time is up. It's been really, really brilliant. So thank you so much. So the award-winning content marketeer and cultural insight expert, Sarah Rabia, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Sean. I'll go make my sourdough now.
Fantastic. All right. Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.